I think I've officially been doing this podcast for too long now. I no longer get like that little sense of butterflies when I see the countdown going down there. It's like,
yeah, this is old hat for you now. You know,
yeah, actually,
seasoned you know veteran.
You know what, Mike? I just went over 4 years. I've gone over 3 years of doing this full time. I'm almost at 4 years doing it in general.
That's great.
August 1st of this month, I kind of had like a realization that August 1st of this month was the last day that I held a real job.
Oh, yeah.
So I've been doing this for full time for 3 years now.
That's great. That's great. It's a good thing.
You pronounce stupid wrong.
Listen, no, I've been a magazine editor I've been publishing a billiard magazine for 42 years. So please don't tell me about you know, weird decisions, life changes.
Every time you say that, it like just kind of like makes me like, you age well, buddy. You do, you age well.
But you know, you always look at it in terms of, okay, I'm talking to you and you're like, let's see, 42 years ago, I was not even in consideration.
42 years ago, yeah, I was not even swimming.
Yes, not even swimming, yep. So,
yeah, so.
But anyways. That's why we stick around this industry, though. It's fun stuff.
Yeah, yeah, it is. It's good. It's something, anyways. I don't know. Beats the alternative, right?
It does.
The alternative. When am I getting my new magazine? It should be dropping soon, right?
Yeah, September. You should get, you know, by Tuesday, I would hope. Yeah.
Any insight? What's the who's the cover on?
I knew you were going to ask me that. As God is my witness right here, I can't think of what the cover was. Oh, yeah, boy. That's bad, isn't it?
Oh, it's not great.
Well, when you do these one after the next, Amber.
Amber?
From the Canadian, the woman champion. From China, Amber.
Oh, cool.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'd like never heard of her before, which is cool. Yeah. I mean, it's
well, she's one. She was a former junior world champion.
Yeah.
And I think she had a top five finish in a world championship 3 or 4 years ago when she was really young. I mean, now she's still only 22 or 23, right?
I was gonna say, yeah, she's not very old.
Yeah. So, so it was a good story. You know, good. You know, a nice win for her and, sure. You know, starting to see a couple tournaments where it's not automatically Kelly Fisher even making the final match. So it's good to see that the women pro events are getting a little bit stiffer, a little bit more competitive as more of these other players come into the mix, Asian players, European players, which we all kind of knew was going to happen over time. And it would just make, you know, beef up the competition. You're just, you know, there's more than two tough matches, a tournament for someone like Kelly or, you know, someone like that. So, yeah, all good things for the women's tour.
Sure. Yep. Agreed. Okay. Well, I guess, I don't know. Let's jump into this week's topics, I guess. Let's talk about the Asian Open. What were your takeaways? Any big broad things that stuck out?
You know, we've talked for the past year and a half about when are we going to see Asian players coming over here. When are we going to see an event in Asia? How important that is to the world scene. It had been really pretty much just Europe and the U.S. was all that was going on in pool. And we know how many great players there are in Asia. So it was great to see a pro event teed up in Singapore and, have Matchroom kind of make their connection to that event and help it along with streaming and with commentary and marketing. I think that was a really nice bonus for that event. So it gave it a lot more worldwide exposure, made it feel a little bit more like it was part of the international pool scene, even though it was all Asian players. Still, I thought it was a really good step forward. Great to see the Asian players again. I'm sure it's great for them to be in some head-to-head competition again. It was a good event all in all. What did you think?
I thought that the quality of pool was incredible. But it really makes me love those breaking rules for the European Open so much more.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, all of the players are breaking from the right rail, and they're all breaking at like 10 miles an hour, and they're getting that wing ball down. They're getting that one ball banked off of.
Getting
the ball to bank. Yeah, everybody, if you're here, let us know that you're here. Give a little share. Make sure that we can hear you. We're not used to going this long without seeing.
Make sure you can hear us.
So give it a share and let us know that you're out there in the comments. You usually don't go this long without seeing somebody chime in and say hi. So I mean the breaking rules were, it's just, I don't know. I just don't know. I mean, the breaking rules for the European Open were so amazing, and the break and run percentage was 25 to 30%. It was really nice, and now we're seeing like over 50% break and run percentage. And Matt Poland, bless that guy. He is like the best ever when it comes to the stats and stuff. But let me see. He sent me some messages yesterday about it. Here we are. He said the breaker won 88% of the games in the finals. Like, I don't know. The break and run fest, Ko ran 50% of his breaks. James Aranis broke and ran 75%. I mean,
what it's doing is it's just pointing out, now that you can measure one against the other, now that we did have a major tournament with a different format, you can look at one and the other, and it kind of makes the disparity even greater when you see them both in front of you. You're like, yeah, this really is pretty boring, isn't it? I mean, these guys are too good for the game to be that easy. So, and again, we talked about this before, but, it's going to be interesting to see next year, how strict, if Matchroom sticks with its format from the European Open, how much muscle it's going to put on its event partners to follow suit in 2023 and create a more uniform, give you a better idea of who really are the best players and who aren't, and what the rankings are always kind of weird when you've got different formats. To really dial into one, I think would give us a really better idea as to what the true rankings are. I agree with you. It's not a lot of fun to just watch the break and run, break and run, break and run when it's that easy. I love watching a break and run. When you watched a break and run at the European Open, it was like, damn, that guy negotiated a pretty tough out. When you watch a break and run at the Asian Open, it's, break the balls, throw them in. I think, it was still quality of play was amazing. And amazing players, and even, whatever format you're going to get, the cream rises and you've got, top players in the final four. So, it's something that will continue to be addressed as different events, keep using the different formats.
I will say this, the run out that Koping Yi had to complete the tournament, or to the run out when it was 12 to 11, I believe he was up.
Correct.
That run out was pretty good.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that's what you want to see guys like that do. You want to see them do that more often. You want to be amazed more often than just shrug your shoulders and say, well, Stevie Wonder could have gotten through that wreck. So, that's what you want to see. You want to see more of those final wrecks in there. That said, the final match was great. I mean, it was 4-4, 5-5, 6-6. It was tight all the way to 11-11. And then Aranis got a little bit of an unlucky rub. And, from there it's.
Yeah. Well, I believe that's what's going to end up happening when you have the break rules that are that easy, right? If the break rules are absolutely that easy, it's going to come down to literally whoever gets, a skid or, a bad roll off of the break or something like that. Cue ball comes in. Like, you could honestly say with breaking rules this easy that one bad roll will and can, or certainly can, cost you a match.
Sure. Regardless of whether it's winner break or alternate break. I mean, this was alternate break, so it did add a little bit of, it kept that match back and forth, which is fun to see. But still, yeah, one bad roll, one bad whatever, and your tournament's over.
Yeah. Yeah. So, I mean, that's my big takeaway. And to be honest with you, I missed the shot clock too. They didn't have the shot clock in effect here. And even that last run out, I think, this makes me sad to say, but this might be like the millennial coming out in me. I like all of my videos now a minute to 2 minutes at the most. And the run out of Coping Yi at the end, breaking a ball, and it took him like 3.5 minutes or something like that to run out. And I found myself actually skipping ahead like 10 seconds. I'm not even kidding. Like I love pool. I love watching pool. Obviously I do it. It's my life, but I actually found myself just sitting there. You know, I can only listen to the commentary so much about what they think they're going to do. You know, I look at a shot and I decide what the best shot is in my opinion. And 20 seconds at the most, usually it's within 5 to 10 seconds, I decide for myself what I think the best shot is. And from there, you can listen to like Carl or somebody like that, you know, talk through what the right shot would be. But I don't want to sit there and just like analyze it for 25 minutes. Like,
yeah,
I don't know. My patience ran really thin on that, and I ended up skipping forward. But with that being said, like the run out was fantastic. To play that ball hanging in the jaws, the one ball hanging, was it the one ball?
Yes.
The one ball hanging in the jaws, and to play down the right, that right rail, like hard enough to kind of bend out and right around that six ball straight down the cushion, like right, that shot was so tough, and it was executed so perfectly. And then from there, it was, you know, for the most part, fine. He took a little bit of time on that shot again, on the two ball next, but like it just took a little bit too long, and I like that shot clock.
Like the shot clock, you wonder if he'd have played any differently if he didn't have as much time to think. I mean, he had sent a note saying how, you know, the key was, you know, getting the cue ball past the six ball on that shot from the one.
Yeah.
Because if you hit the six, you might sell out. So I'm sure he's spending his time looking at every alternative since he had the time to do it, right? I still think that he's got it, you know, he's probably a favorite to run out even with a shot clock, but it does change the dynamic of the game a little bit for sure.
They're saying, there apparently was a shot clock. Is that right? I didn't watch a ton. I mean, I watched a decent chunk of this, but when I watched, I guess I actually didn't watch it with the commentary on ever. So I guess it didn't look like it was a 30 second shot clock to me. Do you know?
I don't know for sure.
Okay, I guess I never watched it with the audio on to find out if like the shot clock came into effect. But I looked at some of those runouts and it didn't seem to me like there was a shot clock. Maybe it was very loosely enforced. I'm not exactly sure, but I did not see.
Yeah, you know what? When you don't see a shot clock on the screen, it seems like things take forever. It does. Because I remember watching the European Open, and I could have sworn it was either European or UK Open where could have sworn the other semifinal that was not on the TV table, it seemed to me that they didn't have a shot clock because shots were taken forever, but they did. We just didn't see it. So yeah, I think some of it's just kind of that perception. So
yeah, sure. I will say it was really, really awesome to see James Aranis back in the mix. You know, he's had his visa issues, not able to get back to the USA. I mean, you kind of forget how good that guy was actually playing at the end of his, when he was getting back into, and then he was starting to hit the balls, maybe not at that top echelon level, but he was damn close to getting there. He was in that second tier comfortably, I think.
Sure.
Starting to kind of make his way up, and we kind of forget about him now that we haven't seen him in almost a year, but, the dude can play. And
Great tournament, great run, played a great final. Yeah, he's really close to breaking through, you know, given the opportunity. And I just hope that he gets more opportunities. Now, I don't know whether these guys are going to be traveling. You know, someone mentioned here, why wasn't Dennis at the Asian Open? That I don't know. But would Dennis, James, any of those guys be at any of the big international events in Europe coming up? Who knows?
Yeah, I mean, it's
there's nothing holding them back.
Unless there's something we don't know about as far as like visa issues,
more of a pain in the butt coming back home from Europe. And I don't know if they still have quarantine issues to enforce, things like that. But, I'd like, you know, obviously we'd all like to see these guys out there more often.
Sure. Yeah. So I guess, you know, looking in here, Koping Yi gets first place over James Aranis, Nayuki Oi and Johan Chua get third, fourth, Robbie Capito and Masato Yoshiaka, get Loro Bange and Anthony Raga get fifth through eighth. It's good to see
a lot of Filipinos in that, you know, top eight, and it didn't even include Beato. So, you know, they're playing well.
Yeah. I mean, if you go down, Jeff DeLuna got 9 through 16th in this format. Carlo Beato, Kyle R. Moroto, Demosthenes Polpol, another Filipino. I mean, this is how deep the Philippines is. You can start getting in here, and like I don't even know who any of these people are. I know Raymond Farian got 49 through 64th. He's a great player. He's a kind of an under the radar Filipino monster. Yeah, I mean, I'm looking at this and, you know, the Philippines, I'm sure it was harder to travel for them than it is for others, but, yeah, there's a lot of Filipinos on this list.
Yeah.
And I didn't know Anton's name was Anthony. I thought it was, I've always known about Anton Rega. Cool.
His friends call him Tony.
Tony. I mean, it looked to be a great event.
Yeah.
I'm excited for the idea that this is going to be added to, you know, at the end of the day, like this is nothing more than like a China Open type of event that, you know, the China Open was always a great event and it was always fun to watch, but it just was never marketed in the way that this was. And if this is going to be like a second tier type of tournament and it's marketed this well, I mean.
Yeah. Well, that's the power of, you know, having someone like Matchroom link up with you and get that stream, you know, for everybody to watch and have an English announcer and all that stuff. So it just broadens the appeal when you increase the visibility, of course. So yeah, we'd love to see this more often out of tournaments in Asia. I've never seen the China Open, you know, things like that. So, you know, it would be fun to see more of this coming up.
Yeah. So, yeah, I mean, I guess,
we have the women's event too. You know, Chesca, she's, you know, I saw her play. Have you ever seen her play?
Not in depth, but I've seen her play a little bit.
I saw her play in the U.S. Open. You know, she was played in the U.S. Open 4 or 5 years ago. And I kept thinking, man, this girl is just going to dominate because she played so well and she was fast. And, you know, she played like the top Filipino men players. And it's just surprising to me that she hasn't been, she didn't become a dominant player. She's still young, but she's, you know, she is one talented lady.
Well, there's a few from the Philippines that like, Ruben, Amit is like, well,
Ruben, she's won world championships. So she's shown her class in international fields. I just haven't seen Chesca do that, you know, like I thought she would. When you first saw her play, you're like, holy cow, this girl's a monster. So I hope, you know, she doesn't travel as much as some of the other ones do. I'd love to see her travel more. I'd love to see her more at these other events.
That was going to be my point, is the Filipino women, you never see them travel hardly at all, unless it's a world championship.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, that, you know, hopefully there's enough on the table coming up in the next couple of years for them to, you know, to stick their toe in the water a little bit more often. Because they're great players, I love watching them play.
Well, I mean, there's probably 6 or 7 Filipino women that could come over here, and there's not a U.S. woman that could compete. I mean, Jennifer Breda, we're gonna bring her on for the podcast tomorrow. We were supposed to have her on actually yesterday, but she got a little ill, so we're gonna push it back to tomorrow. We're gonna be doing a podcast, I believe, at 2 p.m. Central Time with Jennifer Breda. But
nice.
You know, If Jennifer's not playing, there's no women in the U.S. that can really compete with any of these. I mean, not currently, anyways.
Yeah, it doesn't seem like it. I mean, I hate that we continually dog on U.S. women players, but you know, maybe now that there's more opportunity to play, and there's more competition, you know, maybe we'll see the level step up a little bit.
I got yelled at actually for not being nice enough to the U.S. women 2 weeks ago. And I'm like, and my defense was like, well, which of the
give
women?
Give me a reason. Give me a reason and I'll do it, please.
Well, I was like, give me some women players out there that are going to compete with these players. It was when we had the Kelly Fisher discussion. And there are some U.S. women that are like, well, Jennifer Beretta and Brittany Bryant. I'm like,
Brittany Bryant.
Come on now.
Yeah, she's kind of like Neil Young, right?
Well, she's Canadian, right?
That's what I mean. She's
Canadian. She's like, you're really, giving me Canadian
she's
not women.
A US player. Yeah.
And I'm like, I'll give you Jennifer Beretta. Jennifer Beretta can compete with Kelly on the lower end. Like, she's not, you know, if they play 10 sets, she's going to win 3, maybe 4 sets. But then after that, you're giving me a Canadian woman. Like, I don't know. Like, I want to see the U.S. And I also got called an apologist last week because I kept on saying, like, the U.S. women at age 18, 19, 20 are just as good, I believe, or damn close to just as good as the European women. The European women just have a better support structure to keep them progressing. And the U.S. has nothing to keep them progressing from 600 Fargo all the way up to 700 Fargo. Like, there's just no infrastructure in place. Now there's a little bit more with the WPBA to keep you involved. But from 2007 to basically now, there was nothing. And like, it just is what it is. I'm like, I'm not trying to dog on the women. And I made a bunch of excuses for them last time. But why would you keep playing? Like, there's no reason to continue playing from 600 to 700 Fargo, or from, you know, age 18 to 21.
Yeah. Well, we want to see American women do well.
Absolutely.
Love to see them dominate.
I would love to see April Larsen become, you know, the next world champion. I love April Larsen. I would love to see players like Taylor Hansen take the game back up. There's a bunch of, you know, amazing players. Kaylee McIntosh is an absolute monster player. I was just about to get there. She's an absolute amazing player. Like, there's a lot of players.
She can be out there often enough to show the progress and to make the progress. Yeah. So we saw what she did, you know, in the last event, and it was impressive. She was an impressive player to watch. But, you know, are we going to see her in that top eight, you know, 5 out of 8 tournaments? Okay, then I got something to hang my coat on, right? So, you know, there are some really good young players who seem to really be devoting a lot of time to it. And maybe the, you know, maybe in a couple of years it starts to show, but at the upper levels right now with the established women American players, it's just not at the level it needs to be.
Yeah. Well, the WPBA needs to keep their, you know, their events out there. And let me ask you this, Mike, because, you know, whether you want to admit it or whether you don't want to admit it, there is an absolute power struggle going on at the top side of pool, right? Between the Predator Tour and the WPBA, the Predator Tour and Matchroom, right? There is a power struggle. Yes, on the men's side.
Yeah.
There is an absolute power struggle. Do you think the WPBA, and of course, they're almost kind of forced to partner with Predator, right? Because the Matchroom has expressed hundreds of times that they're just not even interested in making women's events. They want to open it.
Right.
Do you think that the WPBA, in their long-term interest, has made a mistake by partnering with Predator instead of Matchroom?
No. How are they going to partner with Matchroom? Matchroom doesn't want anything to do with women's events. They established that in snooker, and they've established that in men's pool. And I like that they are encouraging, you know, it's kind of their way of avoiding having to talk about why they don't do women's events, but they encourage women to play in the open events, right? I encourage women to play in the open events. I think that, you know, if there are not enough women's events out there and you want to become a monster pool player, get in those open events. You're going to get your brains beat in for a while, but, you know, half the field is doing that. That's the way you improve. So, but, you know, partnering with Predator, I think that's fantastic for the women. It's fantastic for Predator that they're jumping in and taking on, you know, all these women's events and giving them opportunities to play. So I think it's all good. I think the WPBA has needed a coattail to grab onto for a number of years. And so this year they started to get a little bit better, you know, developing a bigger list of their own events. And then you add on the Predator events that they're coattailing on now, and all of a sudden you got a pretty good year. So, yeah, I'm 100% behind what they're doing.
So mostly, I guess the direction of my question is, I agree exactly. Like the WPBA needed a little bit of a kickstart to get going, and riding the coattails of Predator was definitely a good move for them.
Yeah, absolutely.
But there's some hypocrisy. There's a little bit of hypocrisy from Matchroom when it comes down to, well, you only want to promote open events, but you're going to have a junior event at the US Open. Why can't the kids play? So like, I get the idea of that, but the idea is the WPBA really is looking for somebody to help shoulder the costs of the startup to their events, right? Bring in the tables in. Predator's already going to be there with the table. So they're basically kind of like tagging along with it, essentially, which is the same thing that they're doing with the juniors with Matchroom with the US Open. The tables are already going to be there. You're just repurposing them for the juniors. Why wouldn't the WPBA theoretically be able to attach their events to, and now I guess the US Open is really the only event. So maybe that doesn't make sense where the Predator has the Michigan, Ohio, Arizona, Puerto Rico.
Yeah. Right. So it's, Canada. You know, with the juniors, you're talking about a one-off with, you know, it was originally just going to be 32 players and they upped it to 64. You know, it's just a matter of, that's just kind of a one-off thing, you know, that to show some support for the juniors, and you know, helping junior pool is more important, if I can say this without getting trashed, is more important for, you know, it's a natural step in the progression of Matchroom tournaments, right? You want to get the junior players level higher. They start coming into the pro levels or the open events, whether it's men or women coming to the open events, and it makes those stronger. You've got a developmental thing going on here. If you run a separate women's event, you're just running two separate events, a men's and a women's. So it doesn't make any sense for Matchroom from their marketing standpoint, from their business plan. Right. So, you know, the juniors I can see, so I don't look at that as hypocritical at all. I just think it's more in keeping with their philosophy and their business plan.
Well, the way that they're running their juniors, it definitely is backed up by that, right? Because the women and the men are both in the juniors. Like there is no separate for the men, for the boys and the girls, right? It's
correct.
Just all into one. So
correct.
I mean, that definitely clears out. I guess there's definitely the power struggle at the top, and the WPBA, I guess, kind of picked a side with Predator. And I guess if you're going to be a predominantly U.S. entity, then
WPBA is. I mean, the WPBA is a U.S. association, and it pushes, you know, events in the U.S. I mean, there's going to be some other Predator events that have the women in it. I look at it as, you know, the more the better. And I think they're both doing a great thing as far as the power struggle. You know, that's become a, you know, 9-ball versus 10-ball thing as much as it's become, you know, a Predator versus Matchroom thing. So, I have no idea how that's going to play out over time. It can be interesting.
Yeah, I mean, well,
Predator's got decisions to make, right, with the future of what they're doing. I mean, I like what they're doing, and they're invested for the long haul. But, you know, I think the Canada event was supposed to have a men's division originally, wasn't it? So, how many more times are they going to, you know, take a kick in the butt with trying to run open events, men's events? Before they throw up their hands and say, you guys, you know, we're trying to help you, you just don't want the help, so we gotta focus our money elsewhere.
I feel for the players, though. I feel for the U.S. players, because, like, at best case scenario, I mean, unless you get like a super cushy draw, best case scenario is you're going to a shootout. And do you really want to go from, I don't know, Florida or California to an event in, you know?
I'm not arguing with any pro who decides to go or not go. I mean, they make up their own minds on where they look at their opportunities to compete and make money. But you know, it's a reality is that, you know, Predator has pretty much dug their heels in from a philosophy standpoint of this is how we see growth in attracting fans to the sport. Okay. And still making it competitive. And they'll give you a bunch of stats and facts about how that shootout is not really that different than playing a race to eight and yada, yada. You know, we can go through it. You can create your own numbers and your own stories, however you want to pitch them. But it seems, you know, apparent that this is their direction that they're going to go. So, which is, you know, great for the women because I think they'll continue to do women's events, men's events. I'm not really sure, you know, it's going to be interesting to see how the rest of this year goes with their remaining events and what kind of response they get from the men.
Well, they had a full field in Wisconsin. I don't know if they had a full field in Arizona. I don't remember that. Last I checked, I think they had like 42 or something like that players for the Michigan Open, which is, I guess, a couple.
Yeah, did you? Carl Boyes was on the list. I mean, please, let's get a real list. I saw a list of names, and Carl Boyes was on it, and I messaged him. I said, "Well, obviously he's not going, but the name was on the list. I took a screen capture. I sent it to him. So, so I'm not sure, you know."
So the list
whether these are real lists or wish lists, but you know the list might be who is invited. So if there's 60 signed up, Greg says there's 60 signed up for Michigan, that'd be great. Good event. I mean, it's always they're always going to be.
Yeah, this is
thought of as lesser events without the top players being there. And that might be fine with Predator. As long as they've got 60, 70 players there and they're playing for decent money and they're playing good pool and they're able to, you know, market Predator that way and draw more fans into watching the game, then maybe they can get away without the top players being there. But the events, the titles and the events that go along with them, I think are always going to be looked at a little bit lesser than the Mantrum events just because the strength of the field.
Yeah, it says 64 online. Actually, I better get signed up for this. I was planning on playing. I guess it's closed out now. They're only taking 64, right?
I would get on a waiting list because that would be my
guess. There'll be a ton of dropouts.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, I'm looking at this, you know, Pro Billiard Series event, Battle Creek, Michigan, Carl Boyes. Fargo rate 790, Blackpool. So again, like this might be, a lot of these might just be people who were sent invitations, who knows. But Cowboys is not playing in Michigan, so you've got an extra spot already for you, Nate.
I'm not seeing the Cowboys one.
Maybe it's off the list because I'm just looking at a screen capture. So this is maybe a week old.
But there are a lot of players like Tony Robles has signed up. Well, maybe Tony goes.
Well, yeah, Tony's a Predator guy, you know, ran to Predator events and he's been to a few events. I don't know if he's determined, you know, if he's already signed up for this event or again, whether this is one of those things where he's just on their list automatically. But yeah, like I said, if go ahead and sign yourself up and I'll be pretty sure that you're going to get a spot.
I could test out my new.
No, there's no slam against Predator at the event. I'm just, you know.
Yeah. I could try out my new sweet highest ever Fargo rate. Yeah. And then
what's
I can
your Fargo rate right now?
I'm up to a 674.
674.
Yeah. Wow. I'm almost a decent player now. Almost. Not quite.
Yeah. 674. That'll get you in, you know. You won't be at the bottom of the list.
Yeah, I see there's a couple 400s that are in this, so. Yeah. So, all right. Well, I guess, I don't know. Anything, I guess that kind of wraps up our Asian Open.
It went a little sideways, but that's what these conversations do, which is fun.
Yeah. So, I don't know. I guess let's talk a little bit of Chip and Shane.
Well, that'll be even shorter.
Yeah, well, I mean, it just—I guess it just comes down to I think the you know, there's always going to be this get off my lawn. My generation was better than your generation. And, you know, you'll never be like, I still have people that, you know, come to me with serious arguments that Steve Mizrak is the, like, if Steve Mizrak existed right now, he'd be the best player in the world. You know, I still get those things. And I mean, it's like saying, you know, John Lewis was one of the fastest men ever to run the 100 meter dash at his time in history, but he wouldn't
Carl even make,
who did I say?
John Lewis. He runs the association up in Appleton.
Yeah. True. I think he was also a senator from Georgia, wasn't it? Wasn't he a senator from Georgia too?
John Lewis, yeah.
Anyway, Carl Lewis, sorry, Carl Lewis. But he wouldn't even make the finals. He would struggle to make the Olympics today. I mean, it's like people are just so much faster now than they ever were when he was at his best. And that doesn't take away from his greatness. You just got to take
That's a physical difference. You can, you know, running is running. Playing pool, there's no reason to think Mizrak couldn't play pool as well today.
So if you're going to come with the assumption that the only difference between the players now and then is the equipment and how to use the equipment, sure. But I don't think that that's true. I just think that the level of play has elevated so much now than it has then. And again, we can have this debate for endless amounts of time, but you can't tell me that you could take every player from the 80s, 60s, 70s, and 80s and drop them into right now, and the world rankings would be everybody from the 60s, 70s, and 80s. Like,
no, I don't think anybody would argue that. But I think a point that a lot of people try to make when they're talking about these guys is that, could Steve Mizrak compete as a top 10 player today? He definitely had the ability and the knowledge and whatever to, if he was, you know, 27, 32-year-old Steve Mizrak dropped into today, it wouldn't take him very long to adapt to the level of the game today. So the level brings up the level, right? I've always made that argument about Gene Baloukas versus Allison. Okay, Jean Baloukas absolutely dominated her era. I don't think she was as good a player as Allison. I do think that if she was at her young age, the same time Allison came in, she'd have been head-to-head with Allison the whole way because her game was so good that she would have become whatever, you know, whatever level today's player is at, she could have gotten to that level quickly. Okay, and I think the same with players like Mizrak, things like that. So to talk about him in different eras, you know, take today's player and put him in the old era where they had to really muscle the cue ball around the table, or they didn't have super fast cloth and balls that bounced everywhere. Okay, now those players aren't going to be as good either. Take one of today's players and put him in the 1960. I don't think they're playing as well. So you have to make those considerations and take those things into consideration when you're talking about different eras. So, mm-hmm.
Well, I guess what I was really going with this was what we're talking about here is like the whole idea of the specialized one pocket American player. Now, I think the level of striking has gone high where, you know, 10 years ago, a Chip or a Josh Roberts or a Justin Hall to a slightly lesser degree, or even, you know, kind of Tony Choen to a slightly lesser degree. These types of players could dominate one pocket because the level of striking in the game was not as high as it is now. And now you get to the point where like Fedor doesn't have to know the game that well to be able to dominate. And Shane has really never needed to, although he doesn't really like the game to begin with. But, you know, these types of players, they just don't need to have. They don't need to have the knowledge when they have elite striking, because if you give them one look at it, they're going to run seven and eight and out every single time.
And the easiest way to win is go eight and out.
Yeah. Chip said this on his, he made a concession, you know, kind of a concession post after. And honestly, like, he kind of, you know, it kind of sounded a little sad almost the way he kind of posted it. But, you know, I got to give the guy some, you know, some props. I mean, he flat out said he got whooped up on. I mean, that's hard. That's hard to admit. And he just straight up said, you know, I got my butt kicked. And he said in there, I've never seen a clinic of eight and out like I saw playing against Shane.
Yeah.
And I
think they played on pretty big equipment, didn't they?
I think they did. Yeah.
So, I mean, if Shane can see a pocket, forget it. You're done. So, you know, but there's still a specialty. There's still nuance to one pocket. I just think that these players are seeing it and playing it and using it to learn a lot more than they used to in the days where, you know, those one pocket specialists could dominate. But, you know, you give any of these guys enough time to kind of figure it out. And with their striking ability and their just knowledge of the game, it's going to, I mean, Efren didn't know. When Efren got here, you know, he had never even seen one pocket before coming from the Philippines. Yep. It took him about a year to be like the best player in the world. So, you know.
Well, and if you really look at one pocket, I mean, when is that elite? So we're talking about the elite knowledge of the game, right? So we're talking like the Scott Frost, Chip Compton. We're looking at like their elite knowledge of the game of one pocket. When does that come in the most? Well, it comes in the most, the less balls that are on the table, right? The more it becomes an up table game, the more it becomes
right. Push, you know, everything up table and
yeah. chasing, you know, three or four, but you know, there's five balls on the table and both players need three of them to win. I mean, and they're all up table. I mean, that is when the knowledge of the game really comes into play.
Yeah.
Other than that, the rest of like the big shots that like Tony built a career off of, those are kind of like bells and whistles. Like, but the game of one pocket is not fundamentally built off of those types of shots. Those are kind of like just that makes you in, you know, even better. So the idea is if you don't get to up table games, if the striking is so high that once you see a single opening, you're running out from everywhere. What knowledge doesn't do yet nearly as much good if you
no, right.
get your, you know, if you bank right. your first long rail one in and then run out seven from there.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah,
your knowledge means nothing. I mean, right. not nothing, but you know, in that game, it meant nothing.
Right.
It's the same exact thing that, you know, what Joshua Filler did to Tony Chon when they played in Roy's basement. I mean, those pockets are just too big and you make your first shot and you run out seven. You know what? How good does knowledge help you when
you're
just sitting down watching them run out?
It does. So yeah, it's one pack is just one of those. I mean, I do like watching really knowledgeable players play it and kind of explain what they were doing. I mean, you talk about someone mentioned here, Alex, you know, and Efren before Alex. Alex used to talk about Efren, how Efren would, you know, he would be three shots ahead of his opponent, knowing what he's baiting his opponent into doing, how his opponent's going to respond, where it's going to leave him, and four shots later, he's got the shot that he wants. You know, that's interesting stuff. That makes it fun. That makes it, you know, you kind of like the nuance of it. But watching guys run eight and out, you know, it's like one ball on the spot, nine ball.
Yeah.
So
with no break speed rules, right?
Yes.
I mean, that's it. I mean, so can these one pocket specialists, you know, there's it's like this poison, right? So the idea is, okay, well, we're going to slow the game down on these eight and outs by tightening up the pockets. Well, okay, sure. You're going to tighten up the pockets now. So you're less likely to run eight and out. Great. Well, now does that really give you an advantage? Because now sure, it's going back and forth more, but you're giving up a ton of talent to these players.
Right.
On just, you know, making balls, you know, Shane on a three and a
shot making is your liability against the guys that you're playing.
Yeah,
you know, like you're not in this game because you're a great shot maker.
Yeah. I mean, so we tighten up the pockets of 3 7/8 is to give you the advantage of not allowing them to use their elite striking to be able to run eight and out all the time. Well, now you have to be able to make balls in 3 7/8 pockets, and spoiler alert, you're going to miss more than they will. I mean, that's
yeah.
So where do these one pocket specialists, do they have a future in the game with these other, you know, Shane is not looking to play anymore one pocket. He's made that very, very, very clear.
Yeah, this is the oldest, first time he played since Derby. You know, so, yeah, he doesn't even, you know, he doesn't like one pocket that much. I mean, I saw him interviewed before the Chip thing, and he looked like the most disinterested person in the world. So, you know, maybe Greg's area, maybe, you know, if one pocket tournament should all be on 10-foot tables, maybe that would make it a little bit more interesting.
I mean, to be honest, I love the – there was – who was it that played on the one pocket with just the one pocket – or just the two pockets? Like, Diamond made up a specialty table for it. There's no side pockets and no corner pockets. I mean, that was awesome. honestly, it was awesome. But it changes the game completely. I mean, it absolutely changes the game completely to not have any corner pockets or side pockets. Just
is one pocket so important to us that we want them to come up with special equipment for it and change the game? No. I'm, you know, one pocket I'm happy to talk about two or three times a year, and then I'm moving on.
I was going to say, if we're going to go crazy with it, we might as well go real crazy with it, right?
Yeah.
So I
make it a gimmick, you know, whatever.
I guess Molina, Mike, and they put a ton of work into doing the one pocket, the top five one pocket rankings. And
oh yeah, right.
I mean, I don't know what they were going to end up doing with that. I think that was a project that they maybe never ended up finishing. I'm not actually sure, but I mean, you throw them out. I mean, you can keep Dennis and you can keep Alex on there because those guys are elite strikers as well. I mean, at least Dennis is. I don't know that Alex is still an elite striker. In fact, I would venture to say he's not. But he's still an elite enough, or at least a good enough striker of the balls with the knowledge of the game to still be in that top three discussion. I don't know that you can put anybody else. Like, maybe Tony's the one guy that maybe you still can in my mind. But even still, like, he'll play Fedor soon. You know, there's already talks about Shane and Tony matching up. It won't be till after the first of the year. But if Tony loses to either of them, maybe both of them, that's it. I mean, the one pocket specialist is dead at that point. Like, can they still get there? Sure. But they're going to need weight. They Fedor's been playing the game for a year. Shane hates the game. Josh was played one pocket for 7 minutes before he played Tony. And you're seeing all of these, you know, one pocket specialists lose to them. You know, Fedor's winning a bunch of one pocket tournaments. Like, he didn't win the last one. I think he took second. I'm not, the Texas Open is going on right now. I haven't actually taken a look at the brackets, but I guess I can right now to see how. I know, like, Sky is not a one pocket specialist. He's just a striker of the balls. I mean, he plays some one pocket, but nobody looks at Sky and says, this is a one pocket specialist, right?
Right.
I mean, I know that he's making a deep run.
Right. Yeah. Sky's playing Federer today, this afternoon, right? 3 o'clock or something like that.
Yeah, so of the players that are in here that are already out of the tournament, let's see. Josh Roberts, absolutely a one-pocket specialist, although he's got a lot of talent. He has more talent than – I wish he played more because that dude could be an absolute monster. Jeremy Jones is out. On the A side still, Fedor and Sky, definitely not one-pocket specialists.
No.
Jerry Calderon and Roberto Gomez, definitely not one-pocket – well, Gomez is not a one-pocket specialist.
Well, any Filipino is a one-pocket specialist to me. they can all run deep in one-pocket events.
Okay, so my definition of a one-pocket specialist is somebody who, like, plays the game predominantly. Like, that's what they play, right?
Right.
Roberto is not a one-pocket specialist. No. He can play it at a high level, but it's just like saying Alex Pegulayan is not a one-pocket specialist. Dennis Arcoyo is not a one-pocket specialist. They play it at an elite level, but that's not their game, right?
Right.
And if you look at the one pocket quote unquote specialists on the B side, you're looking at Scott Frost, Tony Choen, Billy Thorpe really isn't. And that's it. I mean, Roland Garcia, John Mora, they're still alive. Nick De Leon, he's definitely not. Charlie Bryant, he's definitely not. I mean, although I guess there's not a lot of, you know, Chip's not in this. Justin Hall's not in this. There's a lot of players in here, I guess, that aren't in it. But I guess my point, yeah, Evan Lunda is another. My point of this, I guess, is I don't know. I think one pocket is now there is no such thing as a knowledge gap when you run eight and out so easily. It just doesn't work.
So you're going to stop seeing one pocket events at tournaments or more of them? Does this cause more events or less?
Ooh, that's a good question. Well, theoretically, if anybody can win them, any pure striker can win them, why wouldn't there be more?
Yeah, I mean, you know, just adding events to a tournament, adding days to keep people in town and adding prize money.
Isn't that good, though, at the end of the day?
Sure. Pile them up.
Less travel costs. I mean, theoretically, less travel costs. But I, to be honest with you, I think that these types of events are going to be kind of slowly fading out. in the next 2 to 3 years. I think by the end of 3 years, we're still going to have the Derby City Classic. Of course, that'll have the one pocket. The Texas Open probably won't be going anywhere. Other than that, there's a lot of events that I could see no longer existing in the format that it does, at least with the players that show up. Like the Midwest Open, for example, in like Des Moines, like I don't see that event getting top players by the end of it. Cause what are you going to play in? You're going to play in a $50,000 added Predator event or a $5,000 added one pocket event, $10,000 nine ball out of it. I mean, as Predator expands their schedule, as Matchroom expands their schedule, I just don't see these types of events thriving in the way that they did 5, 10 years ago.
Right. I agree.
So I think that's, and with those kind of goes these one pocket events. So I don't know though. I'm not, I like watching one pocket in a sense. But would I be upset if I lost Buffalo's one pocket tournament and gained a matchup event? No.
Yeah, I'm a big proponent of professional pool. I want to see professional pool be a sport. I want to see professional pool players be noted athletes, whatever. And I think that, in my mind, you need to narrow down what we're playing so that people can watch it. One pocket will never be a fan draw, ever.
No, not an outside fan, certainly. Outside the industry, yeah.
So, if you're trying to add ripples when your pebble drops into water, one pocket's not it.
Yeah.
So, and, we've got, Matchroom has been the first one to throw the gauntlet down and say, the world revolves around nine ball. So either get on board or, so.
Well, I guess I don't need to talk anymore one pocket at this point.
I don't know. We got a lot of comments on it. It seems like people love talking about one pocket. People, people love matching up in one pocket. People love talking about one pocket. So, but this is the high level pool fan, right?
I think it's probably the same people that, sit around on a Wednesday afternoon listening to us too. I mean, they want all
the God bless them. God bless them.
So, I mean, I'm all for it. I mean, I guess I'm all for it. I don't, it works out for me. So, with that being said, is there anything else you want to talk about for Shane and Chip? Is there any like storylines? I mean, I was not expecting this big of a beatdown. I mean, Chip just got, if you run 8 out all the time. Yeah,
it was quick. I figured Shane would win. And it was over. So I think that's the way we play it. Yeah.
I figured Shane would win, but I was not expecting a 25 to like 13 or something like that drumming.
Yeah.
It wasn't.
Didn't it get to close to like 11-11 or 12-10 or something like that? And then Shane just bolted.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, I didn't follow along that closely. 24-11, yeah. So I mean, that's a drubbing. I guess let's move on from that then. The first two announcements for the Moscone Cup have officially been named. I mean, I guess we...
Should we let everybody in on the secret?
Yeah, I guess. Breaking news. Josh and Shane are... announced for the Moscone Cup, and the poster, I mean, it's poetic. I just have to say it. The poster of Shane, the little poster of Shane where he's shown at the bottom, he's like, looks so annoyed with the fact that he has to be announced for another one of these things.
This is 16th. He's getting up there.
And I mean, you could see his body language last year. You definitely saw his body language last year by the end of it. He was not happy to be there. He did not want to be there.
Yeah.
And I guess at the end of the day, I'm going to pull this up so that we can see kind of what I'm looking at. But this is,
This is Captain America.
This is Captain America. Look at this bottom picture. He looks so upset with the idea that he has to play another one of these things. I mean, yeah, look at that face.
You think with all the photos they've taken of Shane in the last 2 years, they could find one a little more excitement and whatever. Yeah. That was a classic.
I mean, based off of what I'm in London London or Vegas every year for this, and his body language, he did not want to be at this event last year. But
It's not the first time he's done that. It's not even close to the first time he's done that. And he's, you know, when it comes to the Moscone Cup, he's a front runner. You know, when the U.S. is doing well, he's all in. If he sees anything going sideways, he's the first one to look like he's mentally checked out. We've talked to Jeremy about that. You know, how do you keep him from doing that? Because it spills over to the other players. I mean, if they sense that their top player, you know, doesn't really care too much anymore, they're not going to, you know, puts more pressure on them. They're more disappointed, whatever. So that's a whole topic for another day.
And then on the vice versa, you know, looking at Josh, they have him screaming in the background. You know, he's excited. He's, you know, he looks happy. Like the
well, at least they showed him a photograph without Pia in it.
Yeah, that's nice, isn't it?
they would have showed them both.
Even a side picture on the side looks annoyed.
yeah.
But so. Neither here nor there. So I guess nobody's surprised, right? I mean, we already knew that this was coming. This is the good thing about, like, they lose a marketing opportunity by having three players announced as wildcard picks and the actual timing for each one of them. They lose a marketing opportunity. But, you know, you still get excited about it, I guess.
Marketing opportunities how? With what?
The lead up to it. Yeah, the elite.
Well, I think their biggest marketing opportunity is U.S. Open. I mean, that's, you know, you're going to have that's where your points people. I mean, every round is going to be, if this happens, this happens. If this guy wins, this happens. If this guy wins, he's up to this money level. So I think the U.S. Open is going to be just, you know, is going to be crazy from the first round on with both U.S. and Europe as far as points potential. Because if you get a guy sneak into the top four, that's a game changer. Now you're talking big differences in money. So, which is why I'm still like so ticked at Mario He for not beating Albin in the European, because that would have thrown the European points thing completely upside down. It would have turned everything sideways. And then you would have had a real dogfight on your hand at the U.S. Open. But it is what it is. Still, you know, there's just with the discrepancy of, you know, what is top prize at U.S. Open? 50?
No, it's got to be more than that. I'm guessing
60.
I'm guessing 60.
So, you know, anybody starts getting into that top 16, top eight, you make up a lot of ground in a hurry with every win. So it's going to be really interesting, you know, to see how these guys play out. It's going to be interesting for Team USA and for Team Europe. I mean, Team USA, there's a bunch of guys bunched up in that, you know, $6,000 range. Geez, you make the top 32, and you're going to be doing some moving. So it's going to make the U.S. Open, you know. They're going to have a lot to talk about on a daily basis, on a round by round basis.
Yeah. Absolutely.
So that's
on a game by game basis. Really,
that's going to be a ton of fun to watch.
A game by game basis. Could you imagine a situation where, you know, especially on the U.S. side, because it's so easy to point to that, where, like, let's say Oscar Dominguez is down 7-2, and Greg Spanks, since he's in here in the comments, Spanks is winning his, you know, his first 2, 3, 4 matches at the U.S. Open. And Oscar Dominguez is down, let's say 7-2, and whoever wins, you know, one more match theoretically gets into the U.S. side of things. Yeah. You know, you're going to be watching that game by game by game by game.
Yeah,
absolutely.
There's going to be some great drama there. I hope that they, they know that the drama is going to be there. So I hope Matchroom is smart enough to, they're smart enough, of course. I hope they have a roving camera. that they can do little live remote drop-ins from different tables, because
a little they are flying around.
Yeah, there's going to be, you know, there's going to be a lot going on at a lot of different tables at the same time. Every round is going to be really critical. You know, you don't want them getting in the loser's bracket early in that tournament if you got any aspirations for Moscone Cup, whether you're a European player or a U.S. player. So it's going to be interesting.
Well, I guess, Marty Herman, I would like to address that. I like the idea that you have to be so good to play in this event so that other players can get in that actually, quote unquote, deserve it. I can't push back on that hard enough. If you think that you could win this event, or you think that you're good enough to be in it, or you deserve to be in it, or blah, 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 then sign up. At the end of the day, like everybody has the same window to sign up. And if you cannot get signed up knowing when the signups go out there, I give that no credence, because how many players did you see miss out last year? And they're like, oh, this is bullshit. Like, I should be able to play in this. This isn't fair. And then you see, well, did you try to sign up at the deadline? No, I shouldn't have to. I should just be given a spot because, like, no.
I'm with you 100% on this. I mean, we got to stop making the players' beds for them every morning when they get up. Do I agree with him from the standpoint? I would love for events to have a level minimum. Yes, I would like that. If you wanted to say you can't get into this with under 700 Fargo, okay, I'll buy into that. You know, you do want the level to be there, but without that level being there, with it being wide open, everybody had the chance to get in. So nobody should moan about, you know, I should get in, but I didn't want to sign up. You know, show at least a little bit of responsibility if you think you're going to try to prove to us that you're one of the best pool players in the world. I don't think it's asking a lot.
My favorite part about this was when, I'm trying to work on something for the podcast, and I was going through some previous content, and we were talking about Eklund Kachu when he slept in through his match and had to forfeit, or, you know, showed up and he was like two games down or something like that. And Emily was talking about it, and Eklund's like, well, nobody was banging on my door to wake me up. And Emily's like, Eklund, I'm not your fucking mother. I should not be one. Like,
well, yeah, I mean, it is. It's getting to the point.
But that's the idea. Like, if you want to be a professional pool player, some of that requires you actually acting like it off of the pool table. And getting into events is, like, literally fundamental to you actually being a professional pool player. So if you're not going to take it on as a project yourself to be an adult and get yourself into events, then find somebody who will do it for you. If you're that level of player, I promise you there are 300 players who would line or people who would line up to get behind you to help you out with signing you up for a single event. You make one Facebook post about saying, hey, you know, if you guys, you know, anybody out there who wants to try to get me into this tournament, I don't have time to do it. Can somebody try to get me into this tournament? I'll pay you, blah, 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 no problem. I'll guarantee you there'll be 300 people like begging to try to help them with it. But if you don't take it on yourself, but I think he's got a valid point. Marty has a valid point about the U.S. Open for like tennis. But tennis is so much more infinitely organized than what pool ever will be. A lot of those spots are not actually for players. They're for federations, right? The U.S. Open has 128. Is that right? Do you know? No. Off the top of your head? Well, no. They have a lot of those spots are not going out to this player and this player and this player. They're going out to this federation and this federation and this federation. And those federations are just filling those spots. Sure, they have a lot of wild cards too. But, if the Polish Federation wants to say, all right, well, we have seven players. So once we get those seven players, we'll give them to you. And these are our players that are playing. Sure. But if you were to do that right now and you were to go to, you know, what would happen if you go to the Philippines and say, all right, you have nine players. Who are you even going to go to in the Philippines and say, hey, we have nine spots open for your players, fill them. Who would you even go to? And Kuwait, who would you even go to? Saudi Arabia, who would you even go to?
Go to Orlando in the Philippines.
Right. But the idea is it's infinitely more structured than pool has ever or probably ever will be. So you just can't do it the way that other sports to it because we're not those sports.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, well, not yet. I mean, you know, you of course you want to get to a point where there's more of a structure, and there are, you know, the U.S. Open is 100 and, you know, it's not 256, it's 128. And there are 128 players who qualified for it by reaching a certain ranking level or a certain Fargo or whatever it is. You'd love to get to that point. Does that make it more prestigious because it's harder to get into? Sure. But as far as like this year's U.S. Open, having 256 players and it not having any prestige because you got a 400 Fargo in there, I'm not sure where the prestige is still to me at that top end of the event as you get to the meat of the event. Everybody else is just dead money, right? So that's not, I don't have a problem with that. I mean, I'm not worried about, you know, it's not having prestige with who? With people outside our industry, with newspapers or television stations around the country. They don't know any of these guys who are playing in the 256 round or the 128 round. No one's going to start paying attention until you're down to the final 16 anyways. So, you know, at this point, if that's what it takes to get the tournament to where you want it to be size-wise and money-wise and whatever, okay, just keep doing that until you get to a point where you're more organized and more structured, where you can start drawing these lines and making these requirements and still being able to fill your field.
Well, I think the perfect example of this was, you know, since we're talking tennis, the U.S. Open for tennis is going on right now. And I'm looking at, you know, I'm in Beloit at the Carom Room on Monday, and we're playing cards before the break and run down there, and we're playing some euchre. And one of the guys we're playing euchre with looks up at the TV, and there's Serena Williams being interviewed, and he's like, "Oh, that's awesome! Serena Williams won the U.S. Open," and we're like, "No, that was just her opening match." He's like, "Oh, why are they interviewing her for the, you know, why are they interviewing her after her opening match?" Well, we had to explain the situation where, like, well, this may or may not be her last ever tennis professional event. But that goes perfect to what you're saying, right? Nobody knows what's happening in the earlier rounds. Even, you know, the only reason this is relevant is because Serena Williams might be playing her last ever tournament. And so she's going to get interviewed after every single match that she wins or loses, because this might be it for her. And the idea that you would even care enough to like look at this before the final 16 is like a big surprise. And so like the fact that you're interviewing her means that she must have won it, right? So, I mean, but that goes to exactly what you're talking about. The rest of the players are dead money. Even in a tennis tournament where it is an invite, that doesn't change the fact that 80% of the players in that field are dead money.
Yeah, right.
So, yeah. As far as that goes, I mean, I guess the U.S. Open, we were talking about the U.S. Open because we were talking about the U.S. side of things as far as, well, I guess the entire thing about the
match. Yeah, we were talking about marketing, how they're doing the picks. And so the U.S. Open presents, you know, it's, you're going to get three people basically announced for each team at that event, or two people for each team announced at that event. But I still think it's going to be a great, you know, there's going to be a lot of buzz around that event.
Absolutely. Yeah. So I guess looking at the U.S. side of thing, Oscars is 9,000. Sky is 6,000. Wolford is 5.5. Greg Hogue, Mr. Spanky, it's in the chat with us. He's at 4.5. Nick De Leon is at 4.5 too. It's actually, Greg Hogue is $5 ahead of Nick De Leon. Too bad Shane and Sky are, I guess, above them right now. Because how much fun is that? having Spanky and Nick both ahead, like $5 difference.
All they got to do is get to the final four. They're good.
It's hard to argue. Well, not necessarily. What if Sky, Shane, and Shane Wolford are first in the
final
third?
Four? Yeah, well, if we get all USA final four, then I don't care who wins. But yeah, no, I mean, Oscar's looking really pretty good right now. You know, for someone to take a $5,000 shot at him, they're going to have to finish pretty high at the U.S. Open, right?
Sure.
Yeah. So, you know, it's, it's still going to be a lot of fun to watch.
Let me ask you this question, because you're saying he's looking pretty good right now. The difference between Albin and Josh right now is about $7,000. Would you say the same, that Joshua Filler is sitting pretty against Albin? Now, he's already been announced, but theoretically.
He's been announced, so he's done. He's in.
But well then here. Well, I mean,
but you know, if you look at, so if you look at Mario He, you know, and Sanchez Ruiz. Okay, so
that's 20,000.
20,000 difference. That's still, someone's got to finish really high and the other guy's got to dog it.
Well, my point is when you're talking about the European side of things, 5,000 is nothing.
It's nothing. Yeah, it is and it is. I mean, you know, yeah, could Fortunski win the tournament and leapfrog pretty much everybody? Yeah, he could. But that means the rest of those guys can't make a dime. So it's, you know, it's wide open. It's to me, it's more wide open for the Europeans, because more of these Europeans, in my mind, have a shot at the final eight than a lot of the Americans we're talking about on the list. Mm-hmm. Would you say that that's fair?
Well, that, yeah. I mean, that's
kind, I mean, of without trying to denigrate, you know, the players from the U.S. who are in contention.
Well, that's exactly what I'm kind of getting at, right?
There's a much better chance that a Sanjin can go from 11,000 to 40,000 in a hurry than there might be of a Nick De Leon going from 4,000 to 64,000.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
So,
well, that's ultimately kind of my point is.
Yeah. And you've got just a ton of Europeans stacked into that. If you're looking at the straight rankings right now based on money, you know, from
Oscar and Scott,
from Albin down to Ralph Soquet, there's probably 20 Europeans who, you know, if they reach that final eight, final four, could make a big difference. You know, and there's just not that many American players who can have that kind of impact.
Yeah, I mean, ultimately, that was kind of my point. Is 5,000 seems like it's safe for Oscar because of that, exactly what you just said. But 5,000, if the difference between Josh and Albin was, it's even $8,000 between the difference with them. But that's, I don't look at that as being a safe cushion. I mean,
no, because you figure one of them is going to get to the final eight or the final four. And now you're talking a $6,000, $10,000, $15,000, you know, pickup. But again, it's, you know, it's going to have to be, the other guy is going to have to, you know, get virtually no money. Yeah. The guy you're chasing.
Ultimately, it doesn't really matter because Spanky's going to win the U.S. Open and he's going to leapfrog Shane.
That's the other thing. If you're talking to me about, okay, some American player who we don't really know about or don't think is all that great, all of a sudden finishes in the top 40 U.S. Open and leapfrogs all these other guys, I have no problem with that. I want a guy coming in there with a hot hand. Yeah. And if you can reach the final four of the U.S. Open, I don't care who you are. You can be on my team.
Yeah. Go on, Spanx. Get in that top four. And Europe is like 70 countries, right? Just like 70-something countries in Europe.
What is this geography question? I never took these in Trivial Pursuit. I never did the geography questions.
How many countries are in Europe? Oh, 44. Dang it.
Yeah, I was going to say 70 sounds like an awful lot, buddy. But I still
don't know. Well, it depends how you define them, too, I guess. If you consider... it sounds like there can be as many as 51, it looks like, if you consider countries like Russia to be a part of Asia and in Europe. And same with like Turkey and, you know, apparently there can be maybe as many as 51. I don't know, without looking at it.
Seeing as Federer's played for Team Europe in the Moscone Cup, I'm going with Russia being European.
Okay, well... I don't know. I guess, is there anything else we want to discuss? We're right at, I guess, the end of the podcast for what I want to discuss.
I don't know. I'm good. I mean, you know, everybody's been throwing out some really good comments and good questions. I thought I saw Ed on here. One of my questions that I had was, is Sandcastle still a points event for Moscone Cup?
As far as I know. I know Emily kind of said something.
Yeah, I mean, she kind of made reference to it, made seem kind of like it was up in the air. So I'm just curious as to whether there's been any definitive yes or no on that.
Yeah, I guess Ed Ladawi, perk up, put your kid down for a second, answer our question.
I know his literature says it is. I'm just wondering, does Emily say it is?
Yeah. I don't know. Seems like it should be. I hate this. I hate this argument that the U.S. is like, I hate that argument that the U.S. is so under, sure, Europe has a way bigger population. Sure. Europe has way more countries. Sure. And yet we still are only one behind in the total overall ranking. It's like the only time that we ever care is when we're losing, and then it's unfair. But when we're dominating, like we did in the 90s and the early 2000s, like it's, yeah, USA, we'll take an entire continent down, and then we lose, and it's like, oh, well, we got to play against an entire continent. It's just like, that's rich.
That's the way life is. I mean, you know, everybody's against you, and you're getting cheated anytime you lose. And
well, that's true. That's definitely true. Well, Ed must not be out there anymore, so I don't know. I would assume that is the case.
Okay.
I don't see why it wouldn't, unless we actually heard from it. So. Yeah, I don't know. We all good then?
All good. It's been fun.
Yep. Go out
Appreciate
there and buy
everybody's comments and input. It was a lot of fun today.
Yeah, it was. It was a lot of really good questions. That, you know, maybe if. They're almost coming in too fast where we could really address them, but we got to a few of them. It was nice. Hopefully maybe sometime in the future, what we'll end up having to do is, you know, having like a little section where we just talk about the questions, which were fun.
Yeah.
I guess,
is this the last turning stone was Laura's question.
Yeah. I don't know anything about that. I mean, is there something going on that I don't know about?
Well, Mike's been talking about that, you know, for the last couple of turnings since he got sick, but you know, we thought the last one was going to be, so, yeah, we'll see what happens with that. He's, certainly done a lot of events, had a great impact on pool, and he's a one-off when it comes to tournament promoters. So, be a big loss if they stop having that tournament.
That's one of the American good ones that I could see, you know, sticking it out, Derby City. Of course, the International Open, Turning Stone, and like the Texas Open are like, I would say, probably the best American events out there. That's the list. All right. Well, everybody go out there and buy a Billiards Digest subscription.
Oh, yeah. We got to plug Billiards Digest. Jeez.
Yeah. Plug it. Plug it.
Reading is good for you.
Look, Mike hasn't changed out his shirts in like 40 years. He's still, that shirt is at least older than I am. So we need to give him
the shirt's
some money.
A year old.
Well, it looks like it's older than me. So he needs some
money. Well, you know, that's the cool thing. You buy distressed. So it doesn't look like you just got it off the shelf.
Go out, get yourself a Billiards Digest subscription. It's the best. Look at this. Look at this amazing content. Billiards Digest. Go get it.
Be careful, though. It'll make you think.
Well, I'm not very good at that, so I need to practice. All right. Thanks, everybody, for tuning in. Thanks for the awesome questions. We'll see you next week.
Take care.